riding a wave. Voter polling buoying Newt Gingrich's run for the Republican presidential nomination. We're questioning former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Newt Gingrich, on this edition of Iowa Press.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa Public Television Foundation,
Iowa Bankers Association. Iowa banks provide financial services to meet the needs of families, farms, and businesses. More information is available online at myiowabank.com. Iowa Banks, your future, our focus.
Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to the causes and communities they care about, for good, for Iowa, forever. Details at iowacommunityfoundations.org. For decades, Iowa Press has brought you policymakers and decision makers from across Iowa and beyond. Now celebrating 41 years of broadcast excellence on statewide Iowa Public Television, this is the Friday, December 16 edition of Iowa Press. Here is Dean Borg.
After serving 20 years in the U.S. House of Representatives, Newt Gingrich resigned in 1998, but during that time, the 1994 election to be exact, engineering Republicans gaining 54 seats, ending 40 years of Democratic control of the House. Now, he's asking Republicans to nominate him as the party's candidate to run against President Obama. Speaker Gingrich, welcome back to Iowa Press.
It's good to be here. Good to be with you all.
And across the table, Associated Press senior political writer Mike Glover and Radio Iowa News director Kay Henderson.
Mr. Speaker, most polls have shown you surging to the top of the Republican presidential field. You're now, in some cases, considered the front runner. You've had a checkered past. Does this mean voters have forgiven you?
I think voters have rendered judgment and decided that they understand my weaknesses and they understand my strengths, and that they believe that at a time when the country's in deep trouble, they want somebody who has big solutions and somebody who has a track record of getting big things done, like balancing the budget for 4 years, reforming welfare. So I think it's a balanced judgment. And I'm very open to people getting to know me and getting to understand me. And I've tried to answer questions in a very candid way. And I think that's part of it, is that people accept the sincerity of my willingness to talk with them about my life and to talk to them about where I am today and what I would try to accomplish.
And those same polls seem to show a lot of volatility in the race. Is that support soft?
Oh, sure. I think at this stage, we're still going through a testing. I think if you look at the amount of negative ads that are being run in Iowa right now by my opponents,
I would be
very surprised if you didn't see some ups and downs over the next 3 weeks, just because of the sheer number of attacks and counterattacks, all the things that are going on out there. But what I'm confident of is that in the end, a positive, solution-oriented campaign that focuses on President Obama as the only opponent and that offers people specific big ideas, as I did yesterday at the University of Iowa and walking through brain science and its potential for Alzheimer's and autism and Parkinson's disease and mental health. I think a big solutions campaign does have an attractiveness at a time when people think that this country is in substantial trouble.
And what do you need from Iowa?
I always said I had to be in the top three. I think I would like to win, but I think it's unknowable right now. And candidly, given the sheer weight of negative advertising, I have no idea. But I think if I've got to do well enough here, then I've got to do well enough in New Hampshire, which is Romney's real castle. I mean, if he doesn't win New Hampshire, the race is over for him. And then we get to South Carolina and Florida, and I think I will win those, and I think that this will be a very exciting race. But I'd like to win here. I want to do everything I can to win here. But I'm very respectful of, I think, what, $6-9 million worth of negative ads?
Well, let's talk about those negative ads. You have said you're chafing a bit under your vow to run a relentlessly positive campaign. At the core, those ads raise questions about your consistency. How do you respond to the charges that are made in those ads?
Well, I have a 90% American Conservative Union voting record, a 98.5% national right to life voting record. I am the only person in your lifetime to balance the federal budget 4 years in a row, which I thought was a conservative achievement. I helped pass the largest capital gains tax cut in history. Unemployment dropped to 4.2%, which I would have thought was a conservative achievement. I helped pass the first only major entitlement reform in your lifetime, welfare. Two out of three people went back to work or went to school, which I would have thought was a conservative achievement. And that's just in the speakership. In the late 70s, I worked actively with Ronald Reagan. We helped develop supply-side economics with Jack Kemp and Art Laffer and others. I helped pass the tax cuts under Reagan. I helped fight and helped implement the end of the Soviet Empire as a member of Congress. I helped found the Conservative Opportunity Society. You would think there's a point where the sheer weight of evidence beats the 30-second attack ad. And I'm relying on the good judgment of Iowans to weigh the real history versus the 30-second attack ad.
Speaking of the judgment of Iowans, a former Iowa congressman, Fred Grandy, this past week endorsed you. And in talking with him, he told me one of the reasons he did so was because of the current members of Congress and the former members of Congress who said things about you like you're unfit. They question your leadership style. How do you respond directly to your former colleagues who raise those concerns?
I don't respond to my former colleagues. I would tell the public I was a very strong speaker. I helped drive us to a majority for the first time in 40 years. I helped develop the first re-election as a majority since 1928. In the process, as I said a minute ago, if you're determined, remember, I'm getting this stuff done with Bill Clinton. Now, if you are able to maneuver so that you can get welfare reform signed by Clinton, a tax cut signed by Clinton, four balanced budgets signed by Clinton, you're going to make some people unhappy on two fronts. One front are the selfish members who didn't get their particular earmark. And the other front are the ideologues who say, I'd rather have been pure. I don't want welfare reform if Bill Clinton signs it. It can't be good enough. So I say, fine. I mean, if you want the people who are at the trough, who are afraid I'm coming back to stop their earmarks, that's fine. And if you want the guys who are so ideologically pure they wouldn't get anything done, that's fine. But I have a track record of actually getting conservative things done. Some columnist wrote this week, I've had the most effective effort to shift the country to the right of anybody since Ronald Reagan. And that's a fact.
I want to go back to Kay's initial question here on the negative advertising and you choosing not to respond.
Right.
Part of your campaign is not responding to that. But to use a boxing analogy, you know, a boxer hits some body blows early in the ring, in the rounds, to soften up that opponent. And aren't these body blows going to hurt if you get the nomination and go into a race with President Obama? Aren't you going to be pretty battered by negativism?
Well, anybody who thinks you're going to win the presidency from Barack Obama without $1 billion of negativism is kidding themselves. I mean, this president is going to go all... He can't get reelected in a positive campaign. And he is going to go all out to be negative. It's part of why I'm challenging him to 7 3-hour debates, because he can't stand on the same platform and defend what he's doing. But I fully expect the general election campaign on the Democratic side to be unendingly negative and vitriolic. I mean, that's just a fact, no matter who the nominee is. And what I have to prove in the next few months is that I can allow my opponents to say a variety of unpleasant things and cheerfully ignore them and offer the American people. So let's take yesterday. I'll let my opponents be negative, and I'll talk about brain science. Now, if you're any family in Iowa that cares about Alzheimer's or autism or Parkinson's or mental health or traumatic brain injury, I think Newt Gingrich was talking to you. And I'm not sure who the negative ads are talking to. And I'm happy. This is a great gamble. I want to be clear. It's an act of faith in the American people that I can have a conversation with them despite sort of childish negative ads written by clever consultants who are paid a lot of money.
And you think it's paying off right now with you leading the polls?
Well, I think it's probably right now it's a three-way race. I think you got Romney's money, Ron Paul's intense supporters, and my supporters, and I think it's a three-way race right now. I don't think it's clear to me who's going to win the caucus. But I also think the first reaction to negative advertising is, oh, my gosh, if that's true, how could I be for him? The second reaction gets to be, gee, is that true? And the third reaction is, why are they saying those things that are false? And I think that's an organic, you know, but my guess is that by right after Christmas, as we enter the final sprint, most Iowans are going to be sickened of the negativity and sickened of the commercials written by consultants.
What do you make of the polls that show us that an incredibly small number of Republican activists in the state have actually made a firm decision? I mean, we're 3 weeks out, and something like a quarter of Republican actors have decided who they're going to support.
I think it's one of the most amazing years in American history. I don't remember any nomination. The only one that's comparable is 1940, where you had Taft and you had Dewey, and then all of a sudden Wilkie emerges in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
I just think this is a very unusual cycle. People, I think, are deeply troubled. I think this may be the most thoughtful election in modern American history, because I think people are deeply troubled. And you all know, you know this because you've gotten to talk to them. I mean, they're asking real questions. Over Christmas, they're going to have real conversations. It's not just an either-or kind of thing. It's a, what about this? What about that? I mean, and I think that that's actually healthy. I expect that a very substantial number of caucus-goers are going to walk in not having yet made up their mind, showing up as good citizens because they think they should go to the caucus. And genuinely, the arguments that night at the caucus may, in fact, make a significant difference.
And what will turnout be?
I have no idea.
And you campaign often as sort of an outsider. You're going to bring an outside view to Washington. Yet you've been in Washington for 30 years. How do you square those two?
You know, when Calista and I did a movie on Ronald Reagan, we went out and filmed at the ranch. And mm-hmm. it revealed a lot. I had first met Reagan in 1974 and spent time with him. And so I'd known him a long time. But it was very revealing. Reagan spent 1 year out of eight at the ranch. And when you're there and you talk to the people who'd been there and who'd been with him all those years, you begin to realize that part of the reason was he wanted distance. Somebody once said he managed to serve as president without ever being in Washington. And I think that was psychologically true. They used to have a rule when he was governor in Sacramento that if you said we, it meant the people of California. If you said we and it meant the government, you needed to resign. And I mean, Reagan had this very deep understanding. I am probably the longest-term outsider in the Republican Party, in that my views have always been those of outside the Beltway. And if you look at the last 12 years, I crisscrossed the country giving speeches. I worked with various businesses. I wrote books, both novels and nonfiction. I mean, all of these were things where I'm not part of the Washington social circle. I'm not part of the Washington intellectual mix. And you can tell it if you watch. The conservative establishment in Washington is as horrified at the idea that I'll get elected as is the liberal establishment. Now, that should tell you something about the relative antipathy and the degree to which I'm a genuine outsider.
During the debate last Saturday, you took a good bit of lead from your opponents over your lobbying contract.
Right.
They would characterize it as such with Freddie Mac. Do you regret taking that job? And do you regret criticizing Mitt Romney for his activities at Bain in responding to one of his attacks?
I don't regret taking the job because it was a totally legal, non-lobbying, strategic advisory thing. And I'm not going to go through life trying, you know, I think that part just gets mischaracterized. I do regret taking a shot at Mitt. It was foolish on my part. He had taken one more shot at me that he knew wasn't true and made an assertion that he knew was absurd. But it violated all the core principles I have in terms of trying to stay positive despite temptation. It also communicated something I don't believe in. I think people who run those companies have an obligation to run the companies effectively and to do the best they can. And I've said in the past many times that he's a good manager. So it's one of the few times, I think, in the campaign where I said something that I, you know, could have retracted.
Now, when you left Congress, I think it's fair to say, under something of a cloud. You paid a fine for ethics violations. How do you explain that, or do you have to explain in the campaign trail?
You know, it's fascinating. This is, again, something we may well put into a YouTube video or something. First of all, it wasn't a fine. It was the expenses of the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
It explicitly was not a fine. It was, then that day on the floor of the House, Nancy Johnson, the chair, said it's not a fine. Second, what's really infuriating, the two substantive charges were subsequently both ruled in my favor. A U.S. federal judge said I was totally right. The Internal Revenue Service said I was totally right. The Federal Election Commission said I was totally right. Now, you now know, because she recently made a statement, that Nancy Pelosi was one of the Democratic members. So I'll let you judge how partisan the process was. We agreed to a settlement to get it over with, because many of the biggest things I accomplished came after that was done.
Mm-hmm.
The tax cuts, the balanced budgets, all those things came later. And we just frankly had to get it over with. But we were being held hostage by partisan Democrats. They had failed on 83 straight counts I mean, it was an extraordinary abuse of the ethics process.
But one charge did stay, wasn't right. it? The false testimony.
No, the one charge was we had a very expensive law firm. The partner in that firm who was representing me delegated writing a letter to his junior person, who delegated it to a brand new lawyer. The brand new lawyer wrote a letter that was just not accurate. There's no question that letter was not accurate. It was in the middle of a whole bunch of stuff in the house. I didn't read it as carefully as I should have, neither did my staff, because we had faith in the senior partner. That's the only thing. It was a procedural question about one particular letter, and we agreed to pay the cost mm-hmm. of investigating that one letter. That's the only thing we agreed to.
Do you regret anything you did during that period? Would you have done something differently?
Yeah, I would have filed a charge against the Democrats for discrediting the entire process the first day. I would have gone head on at them because it was a totally dishonest process.
Let us shift to the future and your proposal on Medicare. You've suggested some changes in Medicare Advantage, which is what seniors know it as today. You've also been critical in some ways over the past few months of the Paul Ryan alternative, which would give vouchers to the program recipients. I think even you've called it suicidal to make that change, right?
No, what I said was that when you're dealing with something that's in people's lives as much as Medicare, they have to thoroughly understand it, and they have to decide it's acceptable. You can't impose it without them understanding it. Now, so let me just say, because this happens to be a very good day to discuss this, there's a brand new Wyden-Ryan bipartisan proposal, which improves upon Ryan's original proposal, moves us in the right direction, allows people to keep the current Medicare if they want to, applying the same premium support to the current Medicare system, or to choose a variety of new alternatives. It doesn't apply to anybody who's 55 or over today. So there's a transition period that people can be totally relaxed about. I think it's a tremendous thing in breaking the logjam in Washington that you have Wyden, who's a Democrat, have the courage to step out and introduce a bill with Paul Ryan. Second, it's a bill I would certainly be comfortable signing as president, and I think that it's a very important step in the right direction.
And I think that we have a gridlock in Washington.
We
had the deficit debate that wasn't really resolved. How can you talk about getting something done in Congress when it appears as though Congress is so bitterly divided that nothing can happen?
You know, Mike, one of the virtues of age is that I've actually seen this movie before. Mm-hmm. In 1979, 1980, people wrote articles about, is the presidency too big? And it turned out, of course, no, Jimmy Carter was too small. Ronald Reagan, within 6 months of becoming president, nobody was writing articles about how big the presidency was because he fit the presidency. You currently have a president who, tragically for the country, hasn't got a clue how to be president. He served in the state legislature while running for the U.S. Senate. He served in the Senate while running for president. He's had no experience running things. He's had no experience of bipartisan negotiations. And it shows. I'll give you an example of something that would be very easy to do. Webb and Warner, two Democratic senators in Virginia, mm-hmm. have introduced a bill which would allow Virginia to develop oil and gas offshore and gives 50% of the royalties to the federal government, 37.5% to Virginia, and 12.5% to land conservation and infrastructure. The House Republicans ought to take that bill exactly as it is, pass it. So they're sending a Democratic bill to the Senate. Harry Reid would have to take it up. I believe it would pass the Senate. I think there are at least 8 or 10 Democratic senators would vote for it. Is the president then going to veto a bill which increases American energy, increases American jobs, and increases revenue to the federal government? Now, this president probably would, because he is so deeply committed to left-wing extremists that he can't even sign a middle-class tax cut if it has the Keystone Pipeline in it, which is 20,000 American jobs.
And most of the polls show that you and former Governor Romney are ahead of the Republican pack. If you go to a Republican activist, how do you say, this is why you ought to be for me and not Mitt Romney?
Well, I don't usually compare to Mitt Romney. I would go to him and say, there's one candidate in this race who has helped build a national majority twice, 1980 and 1994. Mm-hmm. There's one candidate in this race who's actually successfully moved the country to the right. There's one candidate in this race who's actually balanced the federal budget 4 times. There's one candidate in this race who's actually passed a major entitlement reform. I mean, there is no other candidate who has, for 23 years, I was the longest-serving teacher in the senior military for 1- and 2-star generals. There's no other candidate in this race that has that kind of national security experience. And so I would look at people and say, not compared to my friends, but I think I am capable of getting done the scale of change we need in Washington.
Okay.
There are two Mormons in the race, and you are a recent convert to Catholicism. I've heard voters raise questions about both the Catholic in the race and the two Mormons in the race. At some point, will you give some sort of a speech about the presence of faith in the public square and the people who are office holders and how they live out that?
It hasn't occurred to me to that. I mean, I sort of did some of that at the various faith and freedom rallies,
right,
and the dinners.
But it is becoming an issue on the trail. You had a gentleman who had been hired by your campaign here who has since left after his reference to the cult of Mormon. It obviously is being talked about.
I think, and I've said this in several of the debates, I think having faith matters. I think we should respect each other's right to approach God in our own unique ways. And I'm not going to say anything negative about anyone's religion, and I would hope that people of faith would respect and be glad that there are other people of faith running in this campaign, even if it's not identical.
Mike? And if we go to issues that you're talking about on the campaign trail, you have proposed an overhaul of the nation's tax system. Critics of that overhaul have said that it would drain about $1.5 billion from the federal treasury and would largely benefit the wealthy. How do you answer those questions?
They're wrong. I mean,
what are they wrong about?
What they say, and I think the one study I saw said up front, it's a static model. Well, what does a static model mean? It means if I design a plan that dramatically expands the number of jobs in the United States, their model doesn't count any of the new jobs. So they say that it's disproportionately helping the wealthy. Yeah, except the whole purpose of the plan is to create millions of new jobs. Reagan created, and I helped pass the bill that did it, Reagan created 1,300,000 jobs in 1 month. Now, if you're currently unemployed, that's a pretty terrific increase in your income level if you go from unemployment to having a good job. And so I would say, if you look at the goal of my plan is not redistribution. The goal of my plan is wealth creation by putting millions of Americans to work. And the goal of my Social Security plan is to allow young people to have the right to choose a personal savings account, which would give them 2 to 3 times as much income as Social Security and would make them all capitalists because they would all own stocks and bonds. And it actually reduces inequality over a generation by 50%.
But isn't that a return to trickle-down economics?
No, it's actually build-up jobs economics. Think about this notion. If every young American had the right to have a personal Social Security account, they saved for their entire working lifetime, they had the power of compound interest for their entire working lifetime, you literally reduce inequality of wealth by 50% over the course of a generation because you now have every single person in that generation own stocks and bonds. They all have a real asset, and they all have a real estate.
Okay. Let us go global. You may inherit a world that looks different than it looks today. But in particular, as president, how would you manage and build relationships in the Middle East?
I think that you have to start with a baseline of telling the truth. And you have to start with, you know, now I'll give you an example. There were 11 missiles fired into Israel last month. I think it's pretty absurd to talk about a peace process when one side is firing 11 missiles in a month. There have been, I think, 300 and some mortar attacks and 200 and some missile attacks in the last year. So I'd start by saying, you know, the folks on the Palestinian side have a pretty big obligation, too. I mean, I would also say they've got to quit teaching terrorism in schools, and they've got to quit glorifying terrorism on television. And so I'd be much more direct about what has to be done.
So there'd be no, quote-unquote, peace process in a
I think that a phony peace process is war by another means. And I would call for a real peace process, which begins with a cessation of violence and a cessation of teaching violence.
Let's broaden that then. As troops leave Iraq now, the announcement just this past week, leaving behind an unstable neighborhood, Iran. If you were president right now, what would be you do about Iran?
You know, I was in a dialogue debate with Governor Huntsman the other day, who's been ambassador to both Singapore and Beijing and who's very smart about a lot of this stuff. And he came back again and again and said, look, the greatest national security problem in the next decade is Iran. And I agree with him. And I think that Our policy has to be to replace the current regime, ideally by building a series of economic and diplomatic and covert strategies, much the way we did with the Soviet Empire. I mean, we ultimately collapsed the Soviet Empire without a general war. It's understudied because it's so politically incorrect to believe Reagan actually wanted to do this. But the fact is, the Reagan strategy in the 80s is an astonishing example of a coherent use of power that's not military to gradually force your opponent into a hopeless place. The current Iranian dictatorship has been at war with the United States since 1979. They have killed Americans. They seized our embassy illegally. They held hostages for 444 days. They killed American Marines in Beirut. They killed Americans at Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia. We now have ties in the last 3 or 4 weeks to the bombing of the two embassies in East Africa. I mean, these are bad people who are willing to do bad things, and the sooner we replace that regime, the safer the region will be.
Let's be a little bit more pragmatic, if we could, and come back to some little sort of partisan politics and mechanical politics things. One of the ways that we judge candidates is the way they run their campaigns, because we figure that's how they might run the country should they be successful and get elected. You've had a big shakeup in your campaign last summer. How do you justify that? How do you defend the way you've run your campaign?
I justify it by telling the truth.
Which is?
We had a cultural conflict. I wanted to run the campaign I'm now running. They wanted to run a traditional campaign. If they were still here, we'd have five negative attack heads on television. That's what they do. And then it's not that they're not good people. But they represent a very traditional political culture, which I think is frankly destructive.
How did they get there in the first place?
Because I was trying to figure out how you run for president. And I brought in people who are pretty good at these things, and I watched them for about 3 months. And I kept telling them, I don't want to do that.
You're a tad bit younger than Ronald Reagan was when
4 months.
When he ran for president. Are you healthy and hale and ready to launch the rigors of a campaign?
All I can tell you is anybody who wants to can come and hang out with me for 3 or 4 days, and I'll let you decide whether I've done this my whole life. I'm pretty good at pacing myself. I'm enjoying this immensely, partly because I'm not surrounded by the consultant. I mean, I'm running the campaign I believe in, a campaign of ideas, a campaign that uses the Internet, a campaign that is dramatically different than most campaigns. At least for the moment, it is amazing how many people find it interesting to have a candidate of ideas rather than a candidate of attacks.
And our moment is up.
No, thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We'll be back with another edition of Iowa Press next weekend, same time, 7:30 Friday night, 11:30 Sunday morning. I'm Dean Borg, and thanks for joining us today.
Archive editions of Iowa Press can be accessed on the World Wide Web. Audio and video streaming is available, as are transcripts, at www.iptv.org.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa Public Television Foundation,
Iowa Bankers Association. Iowa banks provide financial services to meet the needs of families, farms, and businesses. More information is available online at myiowabank.com. Iowa banks, your future, our focus.
Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to the causes and communities they care about, for good, for Iowa, forever. Details at iowacommunityfoundations.org.